This week on the Boag World Show, we look at psychology of decision-making and how that influences whether people take action on your website. This week's show is sponsored by Balsamic and Full Story. Hello and welcome to the Boag World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul Boag. Joining me as always is Marcus Lillington. And this week, an audience of people.
Some people.
It's only five because I only decided five minutes ago that I was going to try streaming this live. So it's hardly a massive audience. But it's what now? What immediately things go wrong? What was that, Marcus?
It's just my printer talking. You know, they just start talking, don't they? Making funny, wary noises.
Yeah. Why do they do that? It's weird. Perhaps they're becoming sentient. That's what I think. Mm, anyway, but so we're here, and it feels weird doing it live. Look, there's people waving at us in the chat room.
Yeah, it's live, and I can see you.
I know.
Are just generally weird.
In my ghostly visage with my really shit webcam.
You look like you've got some sort of, like, you know, godly light shining on you, Paul.
Well, I've got a skylight above me. It might be something to do with that. I like seeing you. We should definitely do the seeing thing. It's good.
I'm kind of like just a bit lost for words. That doesn't work in a podcast, does it?
No.
Hello, Paul. Anyway, yeah, I'm really tired because I played a gig yesterday. I haven't done one of those in a long time, seeing my guitars in the background there.
I went to the Llama Tree Festival that happens in Hampshire. Mm-hmm. Or Wiltshire, or I don't know.
It's Wiltshire, isn't it?
Wiltshire.
Chris used to go to that religiously.
Yeah. And I was thinking Marcus should be playing here. It was your type of place. Lots of kind of folky, middle-aged, pretentious, middle-class
beardy
people.
Types.
Yeah.
Yes, I fit the bill very well. Yeah, we're now just a kind of three-piece acoustic thing with very sort of a focus on the harmony. So, yeah, we are getting even folkier as we get older.
Oh, there was...
Our fingers in our ears.
There was one band in the beer tent that literally was just, they didn't use any proper words. It was all that was their entire thing. It was actually
quite
good.
You watched all of it?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. It was really quite good. I quite enjoyed it. But I've never felt more middle class in my entire life. It was just
full of lots of kind of children called Sun and
yes.
Moon and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. Draped in flowers and hippie
so
stuff.
So did your gig go well? That's the question.
Yeah, really good. Yeah, really good. Yeah. Good. This is what's happening in my life. On Friday night, I went to a party for one of my friends who is 70. And then on Sunday, it was for a friend of ours party who is 65.
Wow.
So basically, all the bastards are retiring around me. Aww. It's not funny. Because I just joined a band back in the 90s, and they were all in their 40s then, when I was just turned 30 or something.
Yeah.
And now they're all retiring and going, oh, this is great. Ha 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 ha.
Yeah.
So I hate them all.
But on the upside, you get to be the youngest, which doesn't happen very often anymore.
No. And I am definitely the baby of the band by a long way.
Although I'd quite be up for retiring right about now. That'd be good.
I'd like to play more music because, of course, I've got the bug for it again.
Yeah.
We did a thing a couple of weeks ago as our first outing. We went along to a jam night and just did a three-song session. I thought, this is great. And then we did a whole set yesterday, and I've just got the bug for it again. And that's all I want to do. I don't want to do this web stuff.
No.
So with that...
Yeah, goodbye then. You still can't stop doing visual jokes, Marcus, because it's still an audio podcast. Yeah, exactly. Right.
Oh, it's Andy Clark. Hello, Andy Clark.
Yeah, don't get distracted by the rabble. We don't talk to the rabble. And Andy Clark, you can't get more rabblish than Andy Clark. So, yes, no. We don't acknowledge
people. G'day, geezer.
He's back in the UK now.
Oh, right. Hello.
Hello. That's much better. Lovely. All right. So what are we talking about today? We are talking, we're continuing with our season on conversion rate optimization, which will really confuse all the people in the chat room because this is the second episode of the season and they haven't yet seen the first episode. So, or seen, heard the first heard episode. So we're doing a season on conversion rate optimization, which basically is a giant big advert for my masterclass. Which you can find out more about at boagworld.com/masterclass. And since last week's show, or when we recorded last week's show, I have actually decided I probably ought to actually design my landing page for the masterclass properly, because it's a bit embarrassing when you have a landing page about conversion rate optimization, which is crap. It kind of doesn't work, does it?
That's quite funny, Paul.
I know.
So what made you think that was just like a sort of paragraph of text with no kind of keywords in there and no call to action probably either?
Well, I'm using a platform called Teachable to publish it, which, by the way, I really like and highly recommend, even though I'm not yet on their affiliate scheme. So I don't recommend them yet, because I don't want anybody to sign up before I get money out of it, because I'm, you know, how money grabbing I am. Teachable, yes, is really good, but their landing page is good, but it's not as, you know, you haven't got as much control as if you did it yourself. Okay. So that's what I did, basically. So anyway, I've done that. But I tell you what really struck me from doing that, because basically, it meant that I have been doing design and code for the last week or few days, which is terrifying. I shouldn't. It's like every designer and developer across the world felt a tremor in the force. You know that. Oh shit! Paul's been allowed to design and develop something.
But you're better at it than I am.
Well, yeah, but then you know. Actually, I don't know. I often think a little bit of knowledge is dangerous, you know, that they say that. And so I think I can still design and I think I can still code, but I can't really. So it's probably not that wise an idea. But anyway, so what I tell you what I did realize from doing that is quite how amazing the design Ed and Dan did for that site is. That I feel, you know, what's that, four years old, I think that design is. I feel no desire whatsoever to change the design of that website. And it's so flexible, and it's just a really great experience. I've been seriously impressed by it. It's been really good. And I tell you what, and it made me realize how much I hate redesigns. I don't like this idea of redesigning websites. It just, yeah.
I like you're redesigning the Headscape site as we speak.
Yeah, and my problem with that, the difference between, because we basically had an identical site, didn't we? And this almost drives the point home. So we both had an identical site. I have tweaked and changed my site on an ongoing basis, you know, continually evolving it, and Headscape got neglected, which is understandable. That's not a criticism. And that's the result that you have to do a redesign, while I don't feel the need to, because I've changed my site so much since it was launched, but I've done it in incremental little steps, which I think is much better in my...
Yeah, and it's not, the new site's not a massive change. I don't think you'll go, oh, wow, it's the most different thing I've ever seen. It is a kind of step forward rather than a complete throw it all away and start again. But I'm doing all the content at the moment, which is so hard.
Yeah, it is.
I hate it.
Yeah, it really sucks.
Finding images. Ah!
Yeah. Yeah, images that aren't just pointless placeholders, you know. Yeah, yes. That have actually got value. Of course, the main reason you're redesigning is just so you can kick me off of the same server as you, so that you're not tangled up with my mess.
No, that's not true. Not true at all.
He says nodding. It's video today, Marcus. You're giving it away. So, but what I would
that
like
was quite
to
hard
do...
to do, by the way. I had to really think hard about what I was meant to say and do the opposite with my head.
Yeah, so it is hard.
Can I have a little sleep, you know, maybe when you're doing the sponsor sections?
Yeah, that's fair enough. That's no problem. Get a pillow out. I tell you what it has made me think of, mine. The thing that I do want to do with my site is I'd love to rebuild it with CSS grids. But I'm never going to have time to do it. That means nothing to you. But the people in the chat room...
It does mean stuff to me.
Does it? Why did you look so uninterested? CSS grids are the most exciting thing ever.
No, they're not.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. All right.
I mean, they're a good thing. Anything that enables design to be done in a way that is flexible and gives you more options, which it seems to be the case with CSS Grid, then that's got to be a good thing. But it's not the most exciting thing in the world, Paul.
Hey, I've just had a good offer. Have you seen what's just been... Andy Clark has just talked about us doing a swap of time, so I think he's offering to rebuild Boag World. That'd be a shitload of time I'd be swapping for in mine, because it's a bitch. He doesn't know what he's just offered there. He thinks, oh, it's just a WordPress installation. Can't take that long to rebuild it with CSS grids. You are so going to regret that, Andy. But anyway. So talking of most exciting things in the world, like CSS grid, let's do your thought for the day, Marcus.
Ooh, yes. Right. Let me find my notes. Wait a sec. Here we go.
So professional.
I even have notes and everything. Right. Well, we have been looking at we've been looking at the Gutenberg plugin for WordPress, and we've also been looking at the Craft CMS lately, and which made me start thinking about CMSs.
Yes. Sorry, I'm just laughing at Andy. I'm trying to concentrate, Marcus.
Oh, off to learn CSS Grid. Nice one, Andy. Anyway, so I've just been thinking about CMSs and why we've done what we've done over the years. So a little bit of history. Soon after Headscape started, well, the very start of Headscape, Paul did CMSs on his own. He did, in ASP Classic and stuff
like
that.
I did, yeah.
But anyway, we decided that we should develop our own CMS, because at the time there... There was CMSs like BroadVision and stuff like that, and they'd cost you $250,000 just to get the thing installed, and then they were rubbish. Mm. So we thought, well, let's design a nice little easy to use CMS. So we did, and everybody loved it. I'm not going to go on and on about that. But two things, there were two kind of flaws with it. One was that it was proprietary, which meant, even though I can remember saying to clients that we weren't really doing it, we were kind of locking them into us. If we'd all been run over by a bus, then they would have been stuck with something that they couldn't have taken anywhere else. And that's a bit of a theme for the kind of things I'm going to talk about. And also, we worked for NATS, we still do on occasion, which is the National Air Traffic Services, and their main corporate site was on our old CMS way back in the day, 10 years plus ago now. And anyway, the unpronounceable Icelandic volcano blew its top, if you remember, and the entire northern hemisphere came to a halt, and everybody went to the NATS website. Millions of people went to the NATS website from nobody going to the NATS website. Anyway, it fell over. It didn't get back up. We had to kind of publish some static HTML pages in the meantime. And we realized that our CMS would actually have to be rebuilt from scratch if we wanted it to do the things we needed it to do. And we thought, well, that's a bit of a mad idea. So what else can we do? And at the time, lots of people in requests for proposals have been saying, we want a Drupal website. We want a Drupal website. Can you do Drupal websites? And at the time, we're like, well, no, we don't do that. We've got our own CMS. And it's great. But anyway, we had so many of these kind of custom requests for Drupal that we thought, well, let's look into this. And long story short, we decided to start working with it. We also work with WordPress as well. I can't remember why. The current Headscape site's on WordPress, and the new one is going to be.
But that's because of me. Because Boag World was on WordPress and has been for donkey's years, that you were kind of lumbered with it because of me.
Yeah.
It's all my fault.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's great to have a choice. Mm. We do probably 2/3 Drupal sites, 1/3 WordPress sites. For example, we work for Colt, not the guns, the network people, and their site's a WordPress site. So it just depends. We're able to offer people different choices. And, you know, both of these CMSs are free, open source, and hugely supported software. But we've been assessing craft lately. I don't know if you remember when we spoke to Ryan Taylor a couple of years ago. He uses craft and was saying how wonderful it was.
Mm.
And again, we had a customer request. Somebody we've done some research for said, well, we're thinking about redoing our site and we've looked at craft and we think it's lovely. So we thought, well, we better have a look at it. And it is. It's got probably the nicest back-end interface I've ever seen on a CMS. But we have found that it doesn't do... It's not as powerful. It doesn't offer as many sort of general functionality out of the box as Drupal does. I mean, that's not to say you can't customize it, but there would be a lot more customization. So we're kind of like still along the lines of, yes, it's got this nice interface, but there are too many downsides to it, we think at the moment anyway. And there's the other side of it completely. So what about licensed CMSs? We haven't dealt with anything like that, but there are loads of them. Sitecore's one, for example. And I've always thought that people want to have a licensed CMS, basically so they can have somebody to blame if something goes wrong. It's like kind of you are the provider more so than if an organization came to Headscape and we did a Drupal site for them. If the Drupal community doesn't, you know, if the community doesn't make something happen, a piece of functionality or something like that, then they can't complain to us about it. It's just that's one of the downsides. So
yeah,
that's going on to say, what are your general choices with CMSs? There are your proprietary licensed CMS, like I've just mentioned, and they're likely to be really well designed. And normally you'll find them focused on particular sectors.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore they are particularly good at dealing with a particular sector. But usually they're expensive. You'll be paying ongoing license fees. And going back to my earlier story about the Headscape CMS, you're going to be locked in. Unless it's something that is hugely supported around the world, and just by their very nature, that's less likely to be the case. So your second choice is go for an open source, license-free content management system. But of course, as I was mentioning there, you're at the mercy of the community for updates, security, new functionality, that kind of thing. I mean, and that's the start of all of this, looking at craft, was because Drupal's a little bit behind on its back-end interface.
Mm.
It's getting better. 8 is much better than 7, but it's not quite... It's just that you can do all the kind of nice design your own page type stuff, but it's not as draggy and droppy as some of the other ones are. But hopefully they'll get them. Of course, you can customize anything, but that means time and effort and cost. Just a quick note here. I'm nearly done. This thing with open source, I've written about this in the past. Just because if you develop your own CMS, well, we could have developed the original Headscape CMS and said it's open source, but it doesn't really matter. That wouldn't have mattered. If nobody else is working with your open source CMS, then you're just as locked in as if it was a proprietary system. So just a note on that one. And really, I guess you just need to kind of weigh up the benefits and the negatives with a particular CMS and go with which one makes the most sense for you.
Mm.
In our case, we went for the two biggest CMSs in the world with the two biggest communities, because we think that makes the most sense for us and for our clients.
Mm.
And that's my thought for the day.
Actually, I saw that you were going to do something on CMSs, and I came across an old post that I wrote in 2009, right? So it came from, it was an extract from the website owner's manual, that first book I ever wrote. And do you know what? It's still as relevant today. It's 10 criteria for selecting a content management system, and it reflects a lot of the stuff that you've just said in terms of the back end side of things and managing your assets and customization and all of that kind of stuff. So I was quite proud of myself that you know, it's
you're
still
a visionary,
applied.
Paul.
Visionary,
you
that's
are.
What it is. If you do want to read the article, you can do so by going to boag.world/CMS. I've just created a link for it. So yes, no, that was good. CMS is something that people are always very opinionated about, and no doubt you will receive lots of hate mail for saying whatever you'd said today.
Yeah, yeah.
Marcus at boagworld.com.
Opinion.
Right. So let's quickly talk about our first sponsor, which is still Balsamic. They still haven't learnt, which kind of makes sense because they did create half of the content for this season. I've been working very closely with them on the content for this season. And they're putting out more and more content, which is really useful, especially for non-designers, helping them to learn the kind of basics of UI design essentials so that they can do wireframing and that kind of thing. You can find out, they've created this like resource that they're adding to all the time at balsamic.com/learn. So if you want to improve your wireframing skills or just want to understand what the hell designers do, then go and check that out. They don't end, you know, it's not going to turn you into a designer. Their aim is to do just enough to teach you to do a decent job, it's not a full program to turn you into a designer, but it's great place that you can, learn some of those basics, and they're adding so much more content to that. So they wanted to let you know about that. They don't want to sell you anything. They just want you to go and check out their resource because they think it might be useful to you. Right. So what we're talking about today, we're basically, the whole of today's program is about how the brain works, how we think, and by extension, how that then affects our decision making, and that affects our calls to action and our conversion rate and all that kind of stuff. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. The first thing I want to talk about really is how our brain actually works at a very, very superficial level. This is not a psychology course by any means. But there are a couple of aspects of how we think that I think have a big impact on how we make decisions on websites. So I wanted to talk about those two aspects. The first one is our primal brain, right? So basically our brain is made up of different parts. We've almost got three brains, four if you include our stomach, which has actually got neurons in, which is so, you know, thinking with your stomach is a real thing. So exciting.
Something I've been doing for years, Paul.
Exactly. So anyway, setting aside that stupid thing. So the oldest part of our brain, the most animalistic part, is the primal brain, sometimes known as the lizard brain.
Yeah.
And it has certain characteristics, and it's a lot more influential in our decision making than we would care to admit. And it's got certain characteristics that I think are very relevant when it comes to how we make decisions online and how we decide what calls to action we're going to respond to and what we're not. The first one is that it fears the unfamiliar. Right. So what I mean by that, if you think about it, right, if you're a caveman living on the savannah, the things that you see every day, right, have to by default be safe, right? Because otherwise you'd be dead. Okay. While the unfamiliar things that turn up suddenly and unexpectedly and you haven't seen before, they are potentially dangerous. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's where, you know, a saber-toothed tiger turns up and you've never seen one before, and you go oh, it's pat, something pat, new pat pat pat, yeah. It must be nice. Well, not necessarily. So we're kind of pre-programmed to be suspicious of things that are unfamiliar. Now that goes back to the conversation we had right at the beginning of the show about redesigns. Right. If you suddenly change a website that people have been using regularly, you will get a negative reaction from it. Right. And so if you're very reliant on repeat traffic and repeat users and repeat purchases, then be very hesitant about redesigns. There's good reasons why, for example, Amazon in all of their time have never done a big redesign, at least not as far as I'm aware. I'm sure somebody will tell me I'm wrong. But if you look at it from its outset and all the way through to now, it is radically different. It has changed a lot, but it's done it incrementally, so it still feels familiar. Another classic example of that was eBay, that slowly phased out their yellow. You remember that really acidic yellow, which wasn't the best color choice? They phased it out over a long period of time to allow people to adjust, and it didn't feel like a big change.
Yeah, I remember Jared Spool talking about the the design process that Amazon goes through to make a change.
Yeah.
I'll probably get the details wrong, but it was just ridiculous. They could target 0.5% of their users in a particular country or something yeah. like that, and they would run that for 6 months. You know, yeah. doing an A/B on the old one and the new one, and if it managed to sort of like be massively popular, then they might then do 2%.
Yes.
And take it out on like that. I mean, I'm making the figures up, but it was just I was blown away. I thought you'd just chuck it out there and see what happens.
Well, of course, it all depends on how much money that's worth. You know, a 2% of their audience is worth a freaking fortune. So, you know, you're very cautious as a result. But I know what you mean. We're not all Amazon, right? And we do have to sometimes do redesigns. And redesigns are sometimes necessary. So I'm not saying never do them. But what I am saying is it's really important. What, two things. One is to prepare your repeat users and to give them the option to do things like switch back and stuff like that, or at least onboard them properly. But just as important as that is to prepare your stakeholders. If you work for a web design agency, for example, warn your clients what will happen when they do a redesign.
Yeah.
Because clients have got this habit of looking at the stats and suddenly the number of repeat users has dived through the floor and they go into shock and start panicking, right? And that applies just as much if you work in-house with management as well. So this thing of doing things that are familiar, now there's another kind of knock-on effect of that, which is another thing that I hear a lot, is all websites are beginning to look the same. Right? Andy Clark has said this, right?
So have I.
And you've said it. Lots of people have said it, right? Now, on one hand, I completely get that and how that could be perceived as a bad thing, right? Because it reduces innovation. It means that you don't stand out from the crowd. It means that the design stagnates. It is bad, right? But if we're talking purely about conversion, there is something to be said for having an interface that feels familiar and feels consistent with what else is out there, right? So I'm not talking about things like aesthetic styling or tone of voice. Those are the kind of areas where you can definitely distinguish. But in terms of things like you know, sticking with conventions in positioning of elements and that kind of thing. There is a value of doing that for that sense of familiarity. There are other reasons to it as well, but we won't get into that.
Yeah, don't change stuff just for the sake of it. That's madness.
Or, well, again, you can change things for the sake of it if it's an experimental website and you don't care about conversion. Go for your life. You know, I think there should be sites out there that do amazing and exciting and innovative things. It's just you've got to pick the place to do it. You know, do that on a personal project, not on something where, you know, conversion is optimal. The second characteristic of the primal brain is that we hoard, right? So, you know, you gather your nuts to make it through the winter, right? And so the result of that, of our brains being formed in a world of scarcity, is that we are still very vulnerable to that feeling of scarcity. Now, if this was an unethical course, this is where I would start talking about things like, you know, oh, you know, only 3 rooms left of this hotel, you know, and that kind of thing, which when Joe Leach was on the show, he talked about, you know, that with booking.com, how they've got a habit of doing that and how they create an artificial sense of scarcity in order to encourage you to buy. But I'm not talking about it from that angle.
Everyone's doing that now, though. Sorry to interrupt, Paul. It's really, really getting on my nerves.
Yeah.
And also to the point of, I think it's been proven that a lot of people are saying that somebody's looking at this hotel or something and it's like they're not looking at the date you're looking at and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm very irritated. I'll just ignore it now.
Exactly.
So, you know, does it even work anymore?
Well, it does, because you say you ignore it, but you're not at a subconscious level. It will create a bump in conversion.
I am the commander of my lizard brain.
You're not. But it's nice to think you are. It's cute that you believe you're in control of your own actions, Marcus. It comes with a massive cost, and it's the cost that I'll talk about in a future episode where we talk about the dangers of persuasion. Anyway, long and the short of it. So I'm not talking about that kind of scarcity. What I'm talking about is the fact that we don't like letting go of what we have, whether it be money, personal data, whatever, right?
Yep.
So as a result of that, we are what's called, we are loss averse, right? Loss aversion is a thing. And basically what it boils down to is we feel the sense of loss twice as much as we feel the sense of gain. Right, so it's twice as painful to lose something as it is to gain something, apparently. Right, and that kind of feels about right. It's the same.
I'm always saying that we need to note when things are good. Because we're all complainers, aren't we? Oh, it's raining today, and it's been sunny for 5 months. So, oh, it's raining today; it's awful. It's like, you know, take note of when things are good because people generally don't.
So we have that tendency to hoard. So the result of that is our websites have to work very hard. They have to work hard to minimize that sense of loss, right? And maybe to soften that sense of loss. So, for example, there's a return policy if something doesn't feel of value, or we're going to give you this extra thing to go above and beyond, because we've got to work twice as hard to minimize that sense of loss in order to make a sense of gain worthwhile. And also we have to work twice as hard to show the benefits of what we're offering as well. Okay. And then the third aspect of the primal brain is it fails to consider the future. So it lives in the moment, right? So anything where there are future consequences, it won't be overly worried about, right? So great example of that. There was in America, they wanted to encourage people to put more money away for their pension, right? So they started something called a Save More Tomorrow campaign. So instead of asking people, if I turned around to you, Marcus, and asked you to put more money into your pension today, your lizard brain would wake up. It would go, oh, I don't like loss. I don't like losing stuff. You can't have that money. That money is mine. And it doesn't care about the future. Right. And I know, Marcus, that you're very much like this. But right. But if I turned around, to which this campaign did, if I turned around to you and said, well, look, next time you get a pay rise, agree now that 10% of that is going to be put away towards your pension, that's a lot easier to swallow, right?
Yeah, because lizard brain doesn't care.
Because it doesn't care about the future. So again, there are all kinds of opportunities around that. So the obvious answer is if you had a charity website, give more tomorrow. Right? Get people to commit to donate in the future. 96% of people say they want to give more to charity, but they don't because the lizard brain wakes up, right? So put it off to the future, or offer payment plans on your whatever it is you're selling. So understanding a little bit about how we think makes an enormous difference in how we can position things. So that was one thing, it's a primal brain. The other thing I wanted to talk about is something called System 1 and System 2, right? Okay. So this comes from a book called Think Slow, Think Fast, I think it is. Let me just check. Slow, Think Fast. Yeah, Think Slow, Think Fast, which is a superb book. It's a bit heavy going in places, but it is worth reading if you're into this kind of stuff. And one of the things that it includes in it is this concept of System 1 and System 2, right? So System 2 is our conscious mind. It's the bit of us that makes conscious, informed, thought-through decisions, right? And it's also the part of our brain that does that conscious thinking. Well, System 1 is the things that we do automatically and we don't think about, right? So I picked up my glass a minute ago and took a drink. Yes, I did pause long enough to actually swallow liquid. I know I don't take pauses between sentences. So, and picking that drink up, that was a System 1 action, okay?
Yeah.
Because it was autonomous. I didn't consider it. While as people are listening to this now, they're engaging system two. They're having to think about it, unless you're Marcus, who I can see is zoned out and is currently relying on system one. So a great example of this would be driving a car. When you first learn to drive a car, there's so much to think about, isn't there? You have to change gear, you have to signal.
I can't remember, Paul, but
You have to manoeuvre. Well, I've just been sent on a driver's awareness course, so I know all of this
naughty
stuff.
Naughty boy
now.
School, Paul.
Yeah, naughty boy school. But over time, that becomes system one driven. So over time, it moves across into system one, and it becomes automatic. So an example of system two thinking would be, if I said to you, what's 12 times 24, right? You'd have to work it out, wouldn't you? You'd have to think about it. But if I said, what's 2 + 2, automatic, right? Or alternatively, what's the capital of France? Automatic, okay? So that's the difference between system...
288, I think. Is that right?
I don't know. You weren't supposed to actually work it out. But the face that you pulled showed that you were using system two.
Yes.
Now, why this is really relevant to us is for a number of reasons. One is, we don't want people to have to use system two if we can get away with it, right? Because it's Steve Crew, Don't Make Me Think, right? That people don't like using system two. So if they're made to use system two, they're going to give up quicker. Right. Also, interestingly, people who are engaging system two tend to be more critical. Right. So they're more likely to pick holes in what it is you're offering if they start engaging system two. So they don't like it. They become unhappy when they have to use system two.
Okay.
And a great example of this is when we break people's mental models. Right.
So basically, sorry, I've got to interrupt.
That's fine.
And say something completely crass. So, if I want to sell stuff online, like products, from my warehouse, my website should look like Amazon.
No. And the reason will be, I know what you're saying. You're saying because people know Amazon. Is that what you were getting at? Yeah.
Yeah. So they don't have to think about the process. Or they don't have to go, oh, where do I add more of this item?
Yeah, yeah. I know what you're getting at. And you're right to a degree. The difference is you're not like Amazon, right? There are lots of reasons why you are not Amazon. You know this, Marcus. I know you were just being devil's advocate. For example, you're not going to get the level of comments. Amazon's sales process relies heavily on the fact that it's got comments on everything. There's reviews of everything. You're not going to get that. Even if you do the interface design like Amazon, you're not going to sell as many products as Amazon. So it wouldn't make sense. And so it goes on. But the idea of, the shopping basket and checkout process, you could probably learn from some of the consistency of the way Amazon approaches it and stuff like that. So there are lessons to be learned, but you can't just copy it. But going back to the system one, system two thing, that a great example of where this can create problems, where people end up having to think too much, is Wikipedia, right? Wikipedia used to have a search box on Wikipedia. Great. That's very predictable. We all know how search box work. You type in what you want. But next to it had two buttons, one that said go and one that said search, right? Exactly. Yeah. Immediately you've broken people's mental model and how people think, right? So those are the kinds of problems that you have. I'll leave you to guess which one had which, or did what. So system one and two, grasping that concept is really, really useful as you design to think, am I forcing people to engage system two? Am I making them think? Because if they think, then they're going to be slower in making a decision. They're going to doubt their decision more. They're going to be cynical about what you've got to offer. And they just don't like doing it, so are more likely to give up. All right?
Okay.
So there you go. There's a couple of little basic things about it. I get so much more in the masterclass, but at least that gives you a taster. Right.
This is actually quite interesting, Paul.
I am in shock.
No,
you can't do things like that.
Kind of,
You can't do things like that, Marcus. What you've done is you've just broken my mental model of how you should behave.
Yeah, it's so boring.
Yeah, exactly.
No, this, everybody loves all this stuff about how our brains work. It's fantastic.
Oh,
if you can apply it to what you're, whatever it is you're doing, then that's gold.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, there's I'll come on to that in a minute. And now let me do the sponsor, and then we'll circle back round to how then all of this applies to decisions, because I get so excited about this stuff. I just love it. Anyway, well, I'm going to talk quickly about Full Story. I feel sorry for Full Story. They've just been like now crowbarred into the middle of a rant, a full blown rant. It's not a nice place to be put. Do you know what I mean? I was on a roll and now I've stopped and it's like, oh, I've got to do the sponsor. But I'm really pleased. I mean, they've just supported us for so long. I just love Full Story so much. So Full Story is essentially a session recorder. So you can watch sessions back and watch what they're doing. And I'm actually running it right now on this new spangly masterclass page that I've created. And I'll be honest with you, drives me friggin' nuts. I hate Full Story, right? Seriously, it makes it, because you see people do dumbass things and you're like screaming at them going, why aren't you buying, you know, and why did you do that? But obviously
it's me, Paul, just annoying you.
Is it you going endlessly around? Yeah,
I have an hourly reminder to go onto your site and do weird things.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it past you. But obviously, although it is very frustrating, it really has driven me nuts. There have been some things. This is why I can never run a usability test session, because I just want to slap people around the head, which is not good, apparently. You're not supposed to do that if you facilitate usability testing. But it is fascinating, too. Obviously, I've used it to get real insights that enabled me to work out what people are doing on my page. And that's enabled me to maybe kind of tweak and change how I'm working on it. And you know, like, for example, to begin with, I didn't have a video on the homepage, and I noticed everybody was going and watching a preview of the first lesson. So they obviously wanted to see the quality of it and what it covered. So I created a trailer that went into it. So I've been able to watch what people are doing and adjust on the fly, which is obviously the way you want to work, especially when you're running a site that's about conversion rate. You want to be incrementally improving it. Yeah. And also, I could filter all of my sessions down to see, for example, those people that have watched a preview, what did they then do after they watched the preview? What was their next step? So you can get things like that. And that's enabled me to tweak the landing page based on what I've observed. So if you fancy having a go with it, you can have a go absolutely free. You can sign up and get a month free of their pro account, which basically means it will record as many sessions as you want. You don't need to enter a credit card or anything like that. And then after that, you can continue to use it, which is what I'm doing now, up to 1,000 sessions per month, right? Which for a single page, like a landing page, is enough, isn't it? You know, so you can get away with not paying money for it. Well, I'm only small. I'm not their audience that they're aiming at, is my excuse.
Just keep telling yourself that.
Yeah. So you can try them out by going to fullstory.com/Boag. Right. That's Full Story. Please do check them out, because they've been supporting the season for forever. Right. Let's talk about how we make decisions. That was it.
Yep.
Right. So we talked a bit about how the brain works. Right. How does all of that apply? Well, we are inherently lazy, right? Those two things that we talked about together makes us really lazy. Our primal brain makes us lazy because it thinks we're going to starve if we use too much energy. You know, we don't want to waste energy because we're living, you know, a subsistence lifestyle on a savanna. It hasn't caught up with modern life. So it doesn't want to use energy. Equally, system two is hard work. It's hard work working out what 12 times 24 is, you know? So we tend to avoid it. So we're lazy. And that means that most of our decision making is made by system one rather than system two. Okay? System two will overanalyze. Okay? So we don't want to wake up system two. Because if system two wakes up, were doomed. You know, it'll overanalyze it and it won't make a decision. And actually, there are examples of that where there was a businessman who had the emotional center of his brain where a lot of system one activity got damaged. It's a very famous story. I think he got a tumor that destroyed that part of his brain. And you kind of, your reaction is, wow, he's going to turn into Mr. Spock. You know, he's going to be really analytical. And actually, he lost the ability to make decisions, right? Because System 2 was overanalyzing it all the time and not coming to a conclusion. So, we need System 1. We want people to make decisions with System 1. They're happier if they've made a decision with System 1. So what do we do when we're faced with a decision that's a complicated decision, right? So let's pick an example. Let's pick donating to a charity, right? Let's say I recently spoke at UNICEF, right? UNICEF, an amazing charity. So they do a call to action on their website. And their website is make a donation is their call to action. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens in people's brains when they're faced with a question like make a donation? Should I make a donation? Right? Actually, that's a really hard question to answer, right? Because you have to answer a whole load of criteria. Have I got enough money at the moment, which immediately wakes up the lizard brain? Is this the best charity to give to? Right? Is this the best cause to give to? Will my money be well used? You know, all of those kinds of questions. Yeah. It's a complicated issue. And so what happens? System 2 wakes up, it overanalyzes it, and you give up and you don't do it. And here's a shocking statistic. Only 15% of people that go to a donation page, so they've chosen to go to the donation page, then go on to place a donation. 15%, right? Unbelievable. Okay, so because that is such a difficult question, what our brains do is they substitute it, right? They substitute that difficult question of, you know, well, is UNICEF the right charity to donate to a simpler question, okay? To one that's easier to understand. And basically, that's normally the question, do I have enough money? Right?
Yeah.
And that's where things break down, because it's being substituted for a question, A, that's not really very useful to decide, and B, that's waking up the lizard brain anyway. Mm. So what you can do is you can do the substitution for them, right? So you can simplify that question on their behalf. So instead of the question, you know, make a donation, you could replace that with make a donation to end the suffering of children, right? Because by doing that, what you then change the question in people's minds to be is not do I have enough money, but do I want to end the suffering of children? To which the answer is obviously yes. Okay?
Of course it is.
So it makes it much, much easier. Another example would be newsletter sign-ups, right? Do I want to sign up for this newsletter? Okay. We substitute that because that's a difficult question. You know, am I going to get value out of it? Da, 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 da. We substitute it. Do we want more spam? No. Right? So again, you can substitute it to say, not sign up to our newsletter, but sign up to our newsletter to become a better web designer or whatever else. Okay.
Yep.
So we can kind of help people simplify the question. And alongside that, we could also make it much, much easier to deal with objections that are thrown up by the lizard brain. Okay? So if you take something like newsletter sign up, there are all these objections that arise due to our simplifying it. Do I want to get spam? Well, you can make it clear, we'll only contact you every other week. This is the kind of stuff it's going to include, so you know that it's not spam. You can unsubscribe in one click, right? So what you're doing at the same time is undermining that question that they've raised that is inaccurate, that the simplified question. Make sense?
Yeah, that's effectively, I guess it's almost worth we probably do this anyway, but I have never thought about kind of, well, that's the lizard brain or that's system one, all that kind of thing. But, you know, thinking about what are the objections going to be, how can I handle them? And that's kind of, they are the things that would come out from that lizard brain.
Yeah.
Things, if you're suddenly put in a position where you're dealing with something you've never seen before.
Exactly. Everything I've said, probably people are kind of, you know, oh, you've got to deal with the objections. Oh, you've got to make a compelling call to action. You know, those kinds of things. We all know them, but understanding the psychology behind them, A, helps you remember them. B, helps you justify them when talking to stakeholders, which is a big thing.
Exactly. That's good stuff. As I said, it is quite interesting. Paul.
Good. I'm doing it. Right. Okay. Another thing I want to look at is a little bit about how our perception, how we perceive things, impacts our decision making. Right. So I want to give you two examples. Right. Number one is something called priming. Okay. Now, priming is this idea that is the power of suggestion, basically. Darren Brown uses it all the time, the illusionist guy, mind guy, right? Yeah. So he can get you to pick a certain thing because he's primed you subconsciously to look
he's
for
said
that
it
thing.
30 times in, beforehand, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I know, it does
drives
your head
me
in.
Mad.
Yeah. So the best, the kind of most commercially kind of relevant example of this was supermarkets. If supermarkets play French music, they double their sale of French wine, right? Compared to, say, German wine.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
so
great.
There's all these kinds of, this is priming. So you can use it, in manipulative ways, right? So like Darren Brown does, or like that supermarket example. But remember, we're not going to get into that kind of realm. We're going to look at how to use it for good. The truth is that we're priming people on our websites, whether we realize it or not, right? So everything about our website will prime them to think a certain thing. So at least let's set it up for them to be right, thinking about the right kind of things and giving the right impression of our products and services rather than the wrong one. So a classic example of this was I did some usability testing with international students on a university website that will remain nameless.
Okay.
And I did a one of these snap judgment tests where you show them the homepage and you say, what's your initial impressions? Very, very simple. And without fail, every one of these international students said, oh, that place isn't for me. And I knew damn well why. And it's because they had this big ass image on the homepage, right, of all of their major professors, right, getting some award, all dressed up in their regalia. And every single one of them was white, in their 50s, and male, right? So people weren't seeing people like them on the site. So their conclusion, after being primed that this university is for white old people, was that this website was not for them, and the university wasn't for them. That's the power of priming. Another related area to priming is something called the halo effect. And the halo effect is why politicians that are better looking tend to get elected, right?
You're more likely to believe them.
Yeah, you're more likely to believe them. Your initial impression of something or someone will affect completely unrelated judgments about that thing, right? So this is why aesthetics and design really matter on websites, art direction, those kinds of things. Because if you make a website like Craigslist, for example, right? If you make your website look like Craigslist because, well, Craigslist is successful, so we should look like Craigslist. Or indeed Amazon, because Amazon's website is not very pretty, right? Then that could well backfire on you. The reason that it works for them is because the impression they want to give is of cheap and cheerful and good value for money, right? If the website looks like it saved money, then they will as well. But equally, so you need to make sure your design reflects the values that you want to project, even though it's completely unrelated to the product or service you want. So, for example, if your website has got typos and spelling mistakes in, right? He says, somewhat embarrassed at this point. That will undermine, on a subconscious level, people's perception of you. If they miss that kind of stuff, what else do they miss in the services that they provide?
It's true.
So that's the halo effect. And then, of course, the obvious, another big thing that affects our decision-making is the influence of other people on decision-making, right? So this is things like social proof. But we're going to get into that. We're going to do a whole separate episode on that because we're at 57 minutes and I'm still ranting. and then the final thing to say over this, which is really easy to overlook, goes back to what I was saying about System 2, that System 2 overanalyzes things. It thinks a lot about things. And here is a really interesting fact. The longer we think about something, the longer we have to consider a decision, the less confident we are in the decision that we have made.
I suppose you start finding new issues.
I think you find all the pros and cons and there's not a clear answer. You're overanalyzing it, basically. So oftentimes it's beneficial to not give somebody too long to think through an issue before they're making a decision. Now, you don't want to rush them because you don't want them to go away feeling like they've been rushed. Because if they feel like they've been rushed, then they feel like they've been bounced into a decision. But actually, you're trying to help them feel better about their decision once they've made it, right? So there's a fine line here, but it is something worth considering.
Whew. I do think some people are better at making decisions than others. I think I've had friends in the past that have just gone, they've driven me mad because they can never make a decision because they overanalyze.
Yeah.
And I wonder why that is. I have no answer to it, why some people can just go, nope, that's what I'm doing. We're doing that.
Well, a lot of it comes down to the fact they're more heavily reliant on System 1. So I know, for example,
I wonder why.
Yeah, well, it's the way you're wired and your upbringing, it's nature, nurture, all of that, isn't it? But I'm certainly a System 1 thinker, which means I make a lot of intuitive decisions. Now, that means the result of that, of course, is you make more mistakes, right? Because your System 2 is a much more considered. And actually, there are weird situations where you really do want to wake up System 2. Right. So let's say you wanted to design a form. Sorry, I really need to stop talking, but this is so interesting. I love this stuff. Let's say you were designing a form, right? Like the I've got to fill in the ESTA form so I can fly to America soon. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Now, it's really important that you don't get stuff wrong in that form and that you think about it, you know, really carefully. So actually, you want to wait.
I am a terrorist. Oh, no, I'm not.
In that way, you do realize that the FBI do monitor all podcasts, and now you're going to be labeled a terrorist from now on.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, it's your name on the podcast, Paul.
Oh, yeah, that's true. what was I saying? Yeah, so in a situation like that, you actually want to wake up System 2. So the way you can do that is actually making the form harder to fill in, right? So you could reduce the font size, make it harder to read, make people lean forward and squint at it, and they will pay more attention to it. And that you could use that with public speaking as well, actually. If you speak very quietly and you never raise your voice, and you can use it in meetings as well, you force people to lean forward, you force them to engage and listen more with you, and it engages System 2, and they will pay more attention, and they will make less mistakes. So there you go. Cool. Anyway, enough of such intelligence. Let's do a joke.
Yes, but now we're going back to our normal level. I've got two chemistry jokes.
Ooh.
One from Prescott Perez Fox and another one from Chris Forrance, and they're both awful, but I'm going to do them anyway. I tried to write a good chemistry joke, but it was too formulaic.
Oh, dear.
I tried to tell a good chemistry joke, but it got no reaction.
Oh, those are terrible. You did so well. Last week's joke was amazing.
Come on. I can't keep that kind of level up all the time. One a series. Maybe two. Two a series.
All right. That's fair enough. All right, so that wraps it up for this week's show. I hope you guys found it useful. If you want to know more about this subject, then obviously you can check out my masterclass at boagwood.com/masterclass. Next week, we've looked this week at kind of people generally and how they think. Next week, we're going to look specifically at your audience, how to get to know your audience and how to understand them better. Okay, I think that's it for now. Thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Bye.